We're just going to begin by reading a couple of things here, and then Carol's going to sort of take it away, so to speak. For those of you who have read the book, it's called The Great Divorce, and for those of you who haven't read it, it's still The Great Divorce. But it's not a story about marriage, especially, except Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which Blake described in one of his poems, and which, is it Emanuel Swedenborg, is that the first? Who was a rather weird gentleman, wrote of earlier. And Lewis is replying to that, and Carol's got a lot more on that stuff. But we're just going to, Tom is going to take the part of a prelate who has taken the bus trip from hell to visit heaven and see about staying. And I am one of the angels, I guess, was trying to argue him into staying. One of the criticisms of Lewis has been that, well, I'm finding my place here. What page is that?
30.
Has been that he, in his characterizations, he's much better at his villains than he is at his heroes. And it's not my fault if I sound pretty flat in here. Tom sounds more interesting. He's the villain. Okay.
I didn't do that.
It's page 38 for those of you who have a thing. For those of you who have a book. Those of you who don't, it's still page 38, but you can't look on. And the ghost is wearing his gaiters. That's about all he seems to be wearing.
My dear boy, I'm delighted to see you. I was talking to your poor father the other day and wondering where you were.
You didn't bring him?
Well, no. He lives a long way from the bus, and to be quite frank, he's been getting a little eccentric lately, a little difficult. Losing his grip. He never was prepared to make any great efforts, you know. If you remember, he used to go to sleep when you and I got talking seriously. Ah, Dick. I shall never forget some of our talks. I expect you've changed your views a bit since then. You became rather narrow-minded towards the end of your life. But no doubt you've broadened out again.
How do you mean?
Well, it's quite obvious by now, isn't it, that you weren't quite right. Why, my dear boy, we're coming to believe in a literal heaven and hell.
But wasn't I right?
Oh, in a spiritual sense, to be sure. I still believe in them in that way. I'm still, my dear boy, looking for the kingdom, but nothing superstitious or mythological.
Excuse me, where do you imagine you've been?
Ah, I see. You mean that the grey town with its continual hope of morning, we must all live by hope, must we not? With its field for indefinite progress is, in a sense, heaven. If only we have eyes to see it. That is a beautiful idea.
I didn't mean that at all. Is it possible you don't know where you've been?
Now that you mention it, I don't think we ever do give it a name. What do you call it?
We call it hell.
There is no need to be profane. I may not be very orthodox in your sense of that word, but I do feel that these matters ought to be discussed simply and seriously and reverently.
Discuss hell reverently? I meant what I said. You have been in hell. Though if you don't go back, you may call it purgatory.
Go on, my dear boy, go on. That is so like you. You doubt, no doubt you'll tell me why, on your view, I was sent there. I'm not angry.
But don't you know? You went there because you were an apostate.
Are you serious, Dick?
Perfectly.
This is worse than I expected. Do you really think people are penalized for their honest opinions, even assuming for the sake of argument that those opinions were mistaken?
Do you really think that there are no sins of intellect?
There are indeed, Dick. There is hidebound prejudice and intellectual dishonesty and timidity and stagnation, but honest opinions fearlessly followed. They are not sins.
I know, we used to talk that way. I did it too until the end of my life when I became what you call narrow. It all turns on what are honest opinions.
Mine certainly were. They were not only honest, but heroic. I asserted them fearlessly. When the doctrine of the resurrection ceased to commend itself to the critical faculties which God had given me, I openly rejected it. I preached my famous sermon. I defied the whole chapter. I took every risk.
Yeah, well, that's all we're going to read of that one. Well, we could read on a bit in this, I suppose. I don't know. But it's so much fun to listen to a real prelate.
go to page 42, Tom, and get in the thing about choice there.
Okay.
At the bottom of the page. Will you come with me to the mountains? It will hurt at first until your feet are hardened. Reality is harsh to the feet of shadows. But will you come?
Well, that is a plan. I am perfectly ready to consider it. Of course, I should require some assurances. I should want a guarantee that you are taking me to a place where I shall find a wider sphere of usefulness, the scope for the talents that God has given me, and an atmosphere of free inquiry. In short, all that one means by civilization and the spiritual life.
No, I can promise you none of these things. No sphere of usefulness. You are not needed there at all. No scope for your talents, only forgiveness for having perverted them. No atmosphere of inquiry, for I will bring you to the land not of questions, but of answers. And you shall see the face of God.
Ah, but we must all interpret those beautiful words in our own way. For me, there is no such thing as a final answer. The free wind of inquiry must always continue to blow through the mind, must it not? Through all things, to travel, hopefully, is better than to arrive.
If that were true, and known to be true, how could anyone travel hopefully? There would be nothing to hope for.
But you must feel yourself that there is something stifling about the idea of finality. Stagnation, my dear boy. What is more soul-destroying than stagnation?
You think that hitherto, because you have experienced truth only with the abstract intellect, you think that because hitherto you have experienced truth only with the abstract intellect, period. I will bring you where you can taste it like honey and be embraced by it as by a bridegroom. Your thirst will be quenched.
Well, really, you know, I am not aware of a thirst for some ready-made truth which puts an end to intellectual activity in the way you seem to be describing. Will it leave me the free play of mind, Dick? I must insist on that, you know.
Free as a man is free to drink while he is drinking. He is not free still to be dry.
Listen.
No, you say I can't.
I can make nothing of that idea.
Listen. Once you were a child, once you knew what inquiry was for, there was a time when you asked questions because you wanted answers and were glad when you had found them. Become that child again, even now.
Ah, but when I became a man, I put away childish things.
You have gone far wrong. Thirst was made for water. Inquiry for truth. What you now call the free play of inquiry has neither more nor less to do with the ends for which intelligence was given you than masturbation has to do with marriage.
If we cannot be reverent, there is at least no need to be obscene. The suggestion that I should return at my age to the mere factual inquisitiveness of boyhood strikes me as preposterous. In any case, that question and answer conception of thought only applies to matters of fact. Religious and speculative questions are surely on a different level.
We know nothing of religion here. We think only of Christ. We know nothing of speculation. Come and see. I will bring you to the eternal fact, the father of all facthood.
I should object very strongly to describing God as a fact. The supreme value would surely be a less inadequate description. It is hardly...
Do you not even believe that he exists?
Exists? What does existence mean? You will keep on implying some sort of static, ready-made reality, which is, so to speak, there, and to which our minds have simply to conform. These great mysteries cannot be approached in that way. If there were such a thing, there is no need to interrupt, my dear boy. Quite frankly, I should not be interested in it. It would be of no religious significance. God, for me, is something purely spiritual. The spirit of sweetness and life and tolerance and service. We mustn't forget that, you know.
If the thirst of the reason is really dead, can you, at least, still desire happiness?
Happiness, my dear Dick? Happiness, as you will come to see when you are older, lies in the path of duty. Which reminds me, bless my soul, I'd nearly forgotten. Of course I can't come with you. I have to be back next Friday to read a paper. We have a little theological society down there. Oh, yes, there is plenty of intellectual life. Not of a very high quality, perhaps. One notices a certain lack of grip, a certain confusion of mind. That is where I can be of some use to others. There are even regrettable jealousies. I don't know why, but tempers seem less controlled than they used to be. Still, one mustn't expect too much of human nature. I feel I can do a great work among them, but you've never asked me what my thing is about. I'm taking the text about growing up to the measure of the stature of Christ and working out an idea which I feel sure you'll be interested in. I'm going to point out how people always forget that Jesus...
Here the great ghost bowed.
...was a comparatively young man when he died. He would have outgrown some of his earlier views, you know, if he did.
Yeah, that's fine. The ghost finally goes away humming City of God, How Broad and Far. The second one we're going to read, three of us, is, what is that, 112?
Why don't we start in 111?
Yeah.
Can
you move closer to the microphone?
We've missed that, Tom.
On my union, I don't know.
Well, just say what chapter you're on.
We are in, that was chapter, what was that chapter?
Around that one.
Okay, this is chapter 12. About three pages into the chapter. This is where a woman who is one of the spirits, one of the heavenly spirits, is trying to get her former husband into to make a choice to come back, to come up into heaven. And the her former husband is divided into two people, a little dwarf and a tragedian. And the dwarf holds the tragedian on a chain, if I'm not mistaken. The dwarf is the real husband. The tragedian is the false face. Up there. 111.
No, you're the
dwarf. Yeah, you're the dwarf. You're the step. Okay.
You missed me?
Dear, you will understand about that very soon. But today...
What happened next gave me a shock. The dwarf and the tragedian spoke in unison, not to her, but to one another.
You'll notice she hasn't answered our question. you missed me.
Dear friend, you may be happy about that and about everything else. Forget all about it forever.
At the top of 112. Together?
Of course, it would be rather fine and magnanimous not to press the point. But can we be sure she'd notice? We've done these sorts of things before. There was the time we let her have the last stamp in the house to write her that mother, and said nothing, although she had known we wanted to write a letter ourselves. We thought she'd remember and see how unselfish we'd been. But she never did. And there was the time. Oh, lots and lots of times. I can't forget it. And I won't forget it either. I could forgive them all they've done to me. But for your miseries.
Oh, don't you understand? There are no miseries here.
Do you mean to say you've been happy?
Didn't you want me to be? But no matter. Want it now, or don't think about it at all.
Look here. We've got to face this.
Darling, there's nothing to face. For you don't want me to have been miserable for misery's sake. You only think I must have been if I loved you. But if you'll only wait, you'll see that it isn't so.
Love! Love! Do you know the meaning of the word?
How should I not? I am in love. In love, do you understand? Yes, now I love truly.
You mean you did not love me truly in the old days?
Oh, only in a poor sort of way. I have asked you to forgive me. There was a little real love in it, but what we called love down there was mostly the craving to be loved. In the main, I loved you for my own sake, because I needed you.
And now? Now you need me no more.
But of course not. What needs could I have now that I have all? I am full now, not empty. I am in love himself, not lonely. Strong, not weak. You shall be the same. Come and see. We shall not have no need for one another now. We can begin to love truly.
She needs me no more. No more. No more. Would to God! Would to God I had seen her lying dead at my feet before I heard those words. Lying dead at my feet. Lying dead at my feet.
Well, those are two scenes from the book. That last scene goes on a bit longer. And as the dwarf gets smaller and smaller, finally the tragedian rolls up the chain, and the dwarf seems to be at the end of it, but one can't tell, and puts it in his pocket.
Swallows it.
And swallows it. Mm-hmm. And goes back to hell.
And with that happy note, we can continue. I think there are a couple of more points of introduction to be made. One, I'm going to read the introduction, or the preface that C.S. Lewis makes to the book, because not only for those who haven't read the book, but also because I think he sums up so much of his point in that introduction. And second, I'm going to ask Mary to say something about Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell that he refers to in this preface, and that Paul said a little bit about. It seems like we live in a world that continually tells us that there's nothing absolute. There's no solid truth. There's no right and wrong. Up is down. Backwards is forwards. And that everything is kind of relative to society's homogenized mediocrity, which is the term that I...
You copyrighted it.
I copyrighted it. You can't use it. But we get things like, I'm okay, you're okay, and we're told that everything's okay, so just as long as we don't hurt anybody, as they said in Hurt Care. But this kind of implies some vague sociological definition that shifts back and forth according to whoever is making the verdict. But in essence, I think that this world is telling us the truth about itself, that it has no foundation. And C.S. Lewis is coming back in this statement, in The Great Divorce, with the realization that we all have to make as creatures that, no, this is not true. There is a right and there is a wrong, and we're continually called upon to make the decision between them. And yet in the total depravity that we find in this world, that we have within ourselves as sinful creatures, the only right decision that we can make are those brief and painful moments when we can really say, Thy will be done, to God. So I think I'll read this introduction. Blake wrote The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. If I have written of their divorce, this is not because I think myself a fit antagonist for so great a genius, nor even because I feel at all sure that I know what he meant. But in some sense or other, the attempt to make that marriage is perennial. The attempt is based on the belief that reality never presents us with an absolutely unavoidable either-or, that, granted skill and patience, and above all, time enough, some way of embracing both alternatives can always be found. That mere development or adjustment or refinement will somehow turn evil into good without our being called on for a final and total rejection of anything we should like to retain. This belief I take to be a disastrous error. You cannot take all luggage with you on all journeys. On one journey, even your right hand and your right eye may be among the things you would have to leave behind. We are not living in a world where all roads are radii of a circle, and where all, if followed long enough, will therefore draw gradually nearer and finally meet at the center. Rather, in a world where every road, after a few miles, forks into two, and each of those into two again, and at each fork you must make a decision. Even on the biological level, life is not like a pool, but like a tree. It does not move towards unity, but away from it, and the creatures grow further apart as they increase in perfection. Good, as it ripens, becomes continually more different, not only from evil, but from other good. I did not think that all who choose wrong roads perish, but their rescue consists in being put back on the right road. A wrong sum can be put right, but only by going back till you find the error and working it afresh from that point, never by simply going on. Evil can be undone, but it cannot develop into good. Time does not heal it. The spell must be unwound bit by bit with backward mutters of dissevering power, or else not. It is still either or. If we insist on keeping hell, or even earth, we shall not see heaven. If we accept heaven, we shall not be able to retain even the smallest and most intimate souvenirs of hell. I believe to be sure that any man who reaches heaven will find that what he has abandoned, even in plucking out his right eye, was precisely nothing, that the kernel of what he was really seeking, even in his most depraved wishes, will be there, beyond expectation, waiting for him in the high countries. In that sense, it will be true for those who have completed the journey, and for no others, to say that good is everything and heaven everywhere. But we, at this end of the road, must not try to anticipate that retrospective vision. If we do, we are likely to embrace the false and disastrous converse and fancy that everything is good and everywhere is heaven. But what, you ask, of earth? Earth, I think, will not be found by anyone to be, in the end, a very distinct place. I think earth, if chosen instead of heaven, will turn out to have been, all along, only a region in hell. And earth, if put second to heaven, to have been from the beginning a part of heaven itself. Mary, can you tell us something about Blake?
I think instead of taking too much time on Blake and his marriage of heaven and hell, I thought I'd just read just a couple lines from Dorothy Sayers' introductory papers on Dante, because they really make clear what the problem is in this whole literary idea of evil. That somehow, and I think we inherited it from the Miltonic, supposedly Miltonic conception of Satan being the hero of Paradise Lost. And I think those of you who heard Bob Morcott read Paradise Lost last fall remember that he read that with a great deal of expression and a great deal of care to show that Satan had lots of power and will, but that didn't make him attractive, that he was intrinsically, you know, that his evil really spread all around him. And the problem that Blake deals with is the attempt to get rid of the so-called or the orthodox conception of heaven and hell being heaven being the where goodness dwells and hell where evil dwells. And what Blake was concerned about was the fact that, to him, the whole church had misinterpreted the meaning of evil and good and had put it simply on a morality basis, whereas he felt very strongly that his vision told him that it was all in the realm of the imagination, that that's what produced the right kind of living, and it didn't necessarily mean that it was the kind of morals that we are accustomed to think about. And so when he wrote The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, he was trying to show that a lot of our preconceived notions of where goodness was and where evil was are wrong, and that if we would let our imagination hold sway, we would find out that the right, what the right way to live was. The thing that Lewis and Dorothy Sayers and the Inklings in general, I would say, were trying to do was to restore the imagination in Christ to its rightful position, not throwing imagination away, nor necessarily throwing out Blake or any of the imaginative spirits of the Christian world, but making very clear that we do not live in a world that is without morality, or that God's laws and Christ's fulfillment of them were out of place or have been misinterpreted. And this is what Lewis is talking about, I think, in saying that although he would not refute Blake completely, he does want to make clear that you do not mix heaven and hell in any way, that they're two different places, whether you understand them as physical places or as remember, this is a 20th century woman writing who took firsts in Oxford, so don't think she's just some imaginative old lady that's sitting in some corner dreaming up something. Read her a little bit and you'll find out. Hey, I don't need to get too into this stuff. Hell in a manner is heaven in reverse. It is reality seen as evil and seen so far more perfectly than it can ever be in this world. At the bottom of hell is the miserific vision, as the beatific vision is at the height of heaven. And as the beatific vision is the knowing of God in his essence, so hell is the knowing of sin in its essence. Dante speaks indifferently of the torments, the pains, the penalties, or the punishments of hell. And this language often prompts people to suppose that the torments are punishments arbitrarily inflicted, as a man might beat a boy for stealing sweets. But the intimate analogy between the sin and the penalty shows that the suffering of hell is punishment only in the sense that a stomachache and not a beating is punishment for greed. Now, you can develop that as you like, and you know, in your own thinking. But I think that's important to see in terms of Lewis's work on the great divorce, that he carries this out perfectly in the fact that this is the way it works out. Your stomach ache or whatever it is that you get for what you've been doing wrong, that's where your punishment is, and it'll be just enlarged however you want it to be later.
I think what Lewis points out in here too is that we come to want and desire the stomach ache. Not only
that.
The
greed. Well, that was the trouble with acrylic.
Yeah.
He wanted his stomach ache. His idealistic stomach ache.
Okay.
Those of you who read Dante, this is Tom saying today, they wanted, not only was their punishment just instead of arbitrary, but what did you say about that, Tom? They were incapable of not having their punishment? I mean,
that no one is, that what you got, you know, in a sense, was what you, was your every wish fulfilled, only you saw it much more clear than you ever had before. And that I think a frame of reference for this book and for, and certainly for the way Dante writes about hell is that we pray, Lord, don't give me what I want, because if you give me what I want, I will always pick hell. I'll always pick it. And in the thing that we read, I think that comes out. And what I'm, you know, this is the thing that Lewis has written about before. What am I going to make of Jesus Christ now? You know, well, turn him into something new this week. You know. Rather than he having some kind of, you know, forgetting who the potter is, so to speak.
Blake has a quatrain on that. I wish I could quote exactly, but when you thank for answered prayer, beware, for he who is answered is the devil. You know, just exactly that idea. Gave them the desires of their hearts and sent meanness into their souls, is the psalmist stuff.
One of the problems I had with this book some years ago when I first read it, before I'd had enough experience, now I'm a bit older, a bit wiser, was the entire problem with for example, what we were reading the second time, the love and the pity aspects of humanity that we view in a Greek sense, sort of, as being above all that. When we say that love is evil if it's possessive. And Lewis is saying love, as we know it, is always possessive. That what little, I don't know, we're totally depraved, I guess, is
is the term Augustine uses, that there's nothing, not even the intellect, is above this sinful nature of man. Not that we're depraved and that we're not in the sense that we use depraved, but just that its original sin goes to the heart of every matter. And I was not able to accept that for some time because I hadn't reflected enough on what I had turned all these high desires and high forms, whatever, what I had turned them into, what I was capable of. And every one of these people that one comes into contact with in this book, who's coming up from hell, is really, it really has to struggle with that, whether they choose one or the other. As you probably know, you only meet only one person actually makes the grade, so to speak, and that's the guy with the lizard on his back, the lizard is speaking the lustful thoughts, and the lizard has to die. And it's harder for the if the lizard has to die, we can accept that. Well, people are very spiritual about these things. But the love has to die. Our kind of love has to die. Our kind of pity. Our kind of intellect. All that has to die. All of our virtue. Everything on earth has to die. Everything that we take with us. I think that's something that it takes a while to grasp onto. And it's not. Somebody said that Lewis isn't a comforter. That's not a comforting thought. That in our marriage, for example, we don't really love each other. That's really strange. That's hard to deal with. I don't know.
Yeah, and Yang's saying there's a kernel of that, that real.
There's a spark.
There's a kernel or a spark of that real love in it. That that in the earthly sense it's depraved like the rest of us. But the lizard, when the lizard is killed, it turns into a beautiful stallion or a beautiful horse, whatever it is. You know? And then he says later on, if something as ugly and base as that can be turned into such a beautiful thing, think of what something like mother love can be turned into. You know, but that's such a hard thing to realize, that it all has to die, that even the idealistic or the highest values that we know have to be completely let go of.
Because we've perverted them.
Yeah.
There's a comment. You were making some comment this morning, Carol, about this the case of the lizard, something at the end. He didn't want it. I forget what it was. But it wasn't, he didn't want it killed, but he let it be killed or something.
Yeah, I think that never left him.
He wasn't desiring. It's not like he made a choice of something greater than the lizard. It was just that life with the lizard was so awful that he would rather die, you know. He doesn't say, well, you know, I desire something greater. He says, you're right, it's worse to be alive with this rotten thing than to be dead. Go ahead and kill it.
Even if it kills me.
Yeah, even if it kills me.
I think maybe the best illustration for how right this insight is in the conversation between the prelate and Paul here at the start. We call this the Lessing complex, Lessing, after the German philosopher who made this the dominant image in our whole role of higher education, both on the continent, in England and in America. The last page of the National Observer was on this a couple of years ago, in which one of the professors in one of our universities was expostulating on why parents get miffed about their kids going off to college and becoming alienated from them because all the values that they've learned have become reversed and they live in doubt. And he says, that's the function of the intellect in our society, is to carry this continual burden of this blessing complex, that you're never in error, you're always in doubt, you see. And at the village, Laverne Riki is the most on the point one there amongst our various tapes that you can listen to, where he turns this around, that you're You're never in doubt, but you're always in error. You have to decide. You'll always be wrong, but you've got to decide. And that throws you on to this aspect of grace and faith and what it means. But this Lessing complex is so ennobling to us, like the prelate. He's the noble mind, the noble spirit. He's seeking, and you're always seeking. You're always seeking. This is the university atmosphere that you're going to be going into. And it's true, as true on our church college campuses as it is on the secular colleges.
Yeah, this is what he said. If I was offered truth in one hand and the pursuit of truth in the other, I would pick the pursuit of truth.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
And that's what, it's essentially medieval. I mean, what Lewis is calling us back to is something that the scholastics were very interested in. They were interested in the truth, and we always knock them because they get so long-winded and they end up quibbling for so long. But they really were more interested in the ends than in those means. And we become mean people by being interested in the means, perhaps.
Were you going to say something, Lewis?
No, I was just going to say that you have this superego then of the whole academic community throughout all. We are the seekers of the truth. This is the community of the seekers of the truth, where we are open to all truths, and where we refuse all dogmatism, all indoctrination, and so on, because that which is truly human and makes us the liberating arts is that we release people from any kind of ultimate authority in their life or this continual, perpetual doubt. To live in doubt, that's man's nobility. That's his dignity to live. And then that's what shaped this whole 18th, 19th, 20th century intellectual move. It's a marvelous way he shoots it down. That's what makes T.S. Eliot say that the greatest chasm amongst men, and he's thinking there are thinking, reflective men, is between those who accept revelation, that truth is a given factuality, a facticity, that you can't have an opinion about. You're either seized and captured by it, or you reject it. And he says that the greatest chasm amongst modern men is between those who accept revelation, those who reject it.
I love the way he talks about the town with its continual hope of mourning. You know, here he's been in hell, and yet he seizes upon the hope as being the, not real hope, but just the idea of hope as being the beautiful.
There's a quote that stands, you know, that man gave, no, God gave men open minds so that they could call them. You've got it anyway, kind of thrown out in a lot of discussions. Open mind, but that doesn't sound open mind. That doesn't create open mind. You know, that's a real value for God can make for regular people. You know, you have to have a good response to things like that. And they throw you in the middle of here, you're in the middle of
wants to go down. He says, why don't you go down to hell?
Yeah.
And you find out that hell is such a tiny, small thing that anyone in heaven could not even fit in hell.
Yeah, he points to just a little tiny pit in the ground. Look at that little crack in the ground. God, well, that's the entrance to hell. He says, I can't go down. I can't get through that little gate.
What you notice about that Lewis comments on every one of the characters that comes up on that bus trip, they're all either trying to take hell with them into heaven, which is impossible, or else trying to triumph through pity. I mean, he's beyond pity. There's nothing. Lewis says that kind of pity is not going to last. It hasn't lasted for that woman. She, in the end, when the tragedian swallows the dwarf or rolls him up and puts him into his pocket, whatever he does, Lewis doesn't quite explain that because he doesn't realize himself. The woman just says, well, that's that, sort of. And it's very hard for us to realize. But you can't have it the other way. I mean, you can't have hell able to inflict itself on heaven. And as we are able on earth to inflict ourselves on each other, I'm able to, by self-pity, for example, to make Carol feel guilty, and that's not possible in heaven, and that's not comforting either to us, because I suppose at least we'd hope for that if I go to hell, at least my family's all going to be up there in heaven going, oh, he's not here.
Spending eternity wondering.
That's the thing I really like about that one part there. How heaven is the place where you're not needed, but you're wanted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not useful. You're not.
Yeah. No, I have to have some useful scope for my.
Yeah.
For my talent.
There's only forgiveness for having perverted.
There's no enablers in heaven.
There are no enablers there.
One of the great things about that book for me is that each of the characters in the front of us is a. One of myself, and it's not just one of my past selves. But in any given day, just try this out after you've read it. In any given day, you're every one of them, one time or another. And you know the book well enough that there's kind of a socially redeeming feature of the book, whatever. But you'll find yourself catching. Well, you catch yourself up, and you say, oh no, I'm being Virginian, or oh no, I'm the little lizard, or I'm doing that, or that. And you can laugh at yourself, and because you're laughing, you can make amends for whoever got hurt in the process of doing. And so there's a recognition, there's a remorse, and if there's some humor about it too, you can make a difference with the person who you tried to make so small that they could fit into some little idea you had instead of fitting your head. But to know those characters, that's one of Lewis's skills as a writer, is in a paragraph, he paints a picture of a type that you would never think is really a stereotypical character, and yet you yourself are that character, and you've seen people like that for your entire life. And in a paragraph, he's got everyone in that. That young intellectual is particularly interesting to me about. When you find yourself speaking the voice of one of these goofy guys every day. And it's a good book to get in your.
That's why I was thinking the one arena in the modern intellectual world where it would seem that you've got an exception to this general picture would be in the atheistic existentialists like Sartre, Camus, and so on, who do not accept the Lessing complex and who do believe in engagement, as they said, that you've got the kind of return to Goethe's idea of im Anfang war die Tiefe, in the beginning was the deep. You've got to be there, you've got to be involved, you've got to be hurting where the hurt is. but they choose the arena of their hurt in such a way as to be selective over against any chance to have an unfrozen knee in themselves. And this is their tragedy, as Marcellus pointed out about them, actually. Because Kierkegaard is still dead center over against this whole thing from an existential point. Take any command, he says, any command, you choose the one, and it will lead you to the cross. He says, that's all I ask is honesty, simple human honesty. If you take any one of them, and you're going to see that you're one of those figures. You can't evade that if you will just follow through.
This is one thing that occurred to me in the fall, and as far as, you know, I was trying to figure out one day why I really liked Lewis a lot, and why I liked reading those things for Vespers, and I just really liked them a lot. And I think the thing that John was mentioning, and the thing you were mentioning, Carol, but that Lewis speaks so effectively, for those who read The Meaning of Persons, to so many of my personages at once, you know, and he has cut down my hiding places so well in a book like this. And that, for me, comes only from one source, and that's what it means to speak with authority. Because authority is something that casts that kind of broadcast, you know, that kind of broadcast seed, that's sown in a wide throw, you know, and I can't run out of it. Some of it's going to smack me, you know, no matter how many, you know, how much moral duplicity I can work into my personality. He manages to get in there.
What you find, though, when he exposes you, is that all of a sudden you're not so serious as you thought. You know, you can laugh at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the point of conversion is that of total despair. Despair.
No, what? I missed it.
That's the point of conversion, see? Total despair. And
yeah.
I think that if you can turn it into conversation, you see, then you can evade the conversion.
Uh-huh.
It's like when the ALC dropped their financial support of us, or when I made the remark that conversation is not enough. I believe in conversion. And that's when they said, we're dropping our support. Now, this see, we were no longer the lessing complex of where we're all seekers of the truth, we're open-minded, we're tolerant of each other, we're open to a number of possibilities, the news always breaking forth, and so on. And this was the general context of our own Lutheran church in its establishment approach through its official youth groups at that time. And when they came up here, it smelled all over the place. Because they wouldn't be caught on their knees. This was pietism. Anything having to do with the cross or forgiveness or repentance was pietism.
Yeah, there's a feeling I get in here in that kind of regard of, you know, having my knees unfrozen, you know, and as you were saying, you know, discovering suddenly, you know, when I can laugh at that, you know, part of myself. And I've always felt that parable of the woman at the well that way. When she ran away saying, you know, come and see the man who told me everything I ever did. I don't think that was so much the sensation of, you know, he could list my sins, or whoa, he knew that I was sitting under the tree at 3 o'clock 2 weeks ago and here, you know, but that somebody did know, you know, that what I had concealed so carefully is known, you know, and since it's known, he takes it away, you know, but
That element of in Great Divorce is showing us what really was going on when we resembled these people. That we, of course, at the time are thinking something else is happening. And in this book, you can't see what you really were. And it is so small, just so small and so foolish, and yet you know that is what you were, what you are, under the cosmetics we put on David. And our infinite, never mind infinite, always life.
see, what C.S. Lewis calls the prelate is what Kircher calls a professor. And this is the 50-foot tapeworm of the professor.
What's that?
That's what Kircher calls a professor. 50-foot. That's a 50-foot tapeworm that destroys us from within. We would all be professors, you know. But not actually be involved where it is. Or one of his tremendous essays is quite brief and extremely meaningful. It's the difference between a genius and an apostle. We would all be geniuses. Seeking the truth, but never with authority of the truth. Because authority of the truth catches us out as an error. And we want to be professors. Never in error, always in doubt.
I'd like to ask about if somebody else has got something to say about the problem of everybody wanting to somebody did have something. But about this whole business about why should the lady, remember the wife, being so, how could she be so happy? And they could be condemned. And those of you who have the book with you, what is the book on page 120?
What's that?
It's the 13th chapter. And it's right at the end, right around that last, that psalm. That this song about the lady, you know, and then talks about what we call universalism. And George MacDonald. Well, Lloyd, you want to do something with George MacDonald? What does he say there? He's the mentor. He's the teacher.
I was hoping you'd close.
All through this, you know. Well, Lloyd didn't mention that, but I mean, he is going to.
George MacDonald is the one that actually shot this Oxford Don, C.S. Lewis, into the realization that there was a finality of truth. There was ultimate authority, and this was where it opened up for him, so that's where he became his teacher.
Anyway, page 120 on this edition, the one that you have this.
They have different covers.
I know they do. Well, anyway, this is the one that's in the yellow edition. I think it's still the same page. Surely it wasn't in a reaction. Haven't you heard people say this, you know? How can anybody enjoy heaven if they know, like Paul was saying, if they know that if they know some of their families in hell? Mm-hmm. What does he say about that? That's a really important thing.
Bottom of page 120.
Why don't you read it? That whole section, I think, should read.
Somebody else has read the book besides all of us who
want. And along with what he didn't want any of his disciples to do. Tim, you got it too, and to read it out loud. You got good light in here.
So read the whole page.
The demand of the loveless.
The demand of the loveless and the self-imprisoned that they should be allowed to blackmail the universe. That till they consent to be happy on their own terms, no one else shall taste joy. That there should be the final power that hell should be able to view heaven. I do not know, sir, what I want, sir. Son, it must be one way or the other. Either the day must come when joy prevails and all the makers of misery are no longer able to infect it, or else forever and ever the makers of misery can destroy in others the happiness they reject for themselves. I know it has a grand sum to say you'll accept no salvation which leaves even one creature in the dark outside. But watch these
sophistries.
Sophistry.
Or you'll make a dog in the
in the manger, the tyrant of the universe.
And then down at the bottom of that page, I think somebody could read that.
It's a weapon on the other side. It leaps quicker than light from the highest place to the lowest to bring healing and joy, whatever the cost of itself. It changes darkness into light and evil into good, but it will not, at the cunning tears of hell, impose on good the tyranny of evil. Every disease that submits to a cure shall be cured, but we will not call blue yellow to please those who insist on still having jaundice. Nor make a midden of the world's garden for the sake of some who cannot abide the smell of roses.
There's a whole problem of truth and error. I mean, you know, if you say jaundice, you know what jaundice is? Mm-hmm. What?
Your eyes turn yellow.
And it's really awful. It's terrible.
Can't take any fats and so on. It was a disease of all the malnutrition people during World War II in the various prison camps we had, it, all of us. It happened in Europe, you see.
Well, what's he saying about it?
Malnutrition disease.
I mean, what's that got to do with what he's saying? That's what I was wondering.
Oh, that we can't forever be, sorry for the people who choose to have that stomachache. You can't keep running around and hoping they get better when they're the ones who are choosing to have a stomachache.
Yeah.
It reminds me of part of the Magnificat where it says, "He shall scatter the proud in the imagination of their hearts." It's the proud in that, they're scattering themselves as well as he's scattering them. And it's their choice which way they're going to go. And that's real hard. I like to hang on to sort of universalism, kind of everyone saying the same, because I don't like to say, well, no, they're not. But that's not true, and it's hard because you sort of want to lump people together under a title of Christian charity or something, but that's not what charity is,
This comes out, so I almost thought I have to share just one experience at this point with the philosophy club at the University of Minnesota, which, because it illustrates it so perfectly, including the problem of imagination of their hearts. The chairman for the evening was the head of the psychology department, was reading David Hume a lot right then, had just been through law, and they were discussing a chapter in a book by T.D. Smith, who was a professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago and was then a congressman in Washington, and he'd written this book, Beyond Evil, taking off really from Nietzsche, but there's one particular chapter on suffering that gotten them into a bind, and they asked Professor Swenson, who headed the philosophy department, what he thought evil was, and suffering, and he said, well, if you want to know what it is, ask the man in the street, and he shouted back into his deaf instrument, which he carried on a wheelbarrow in front of him, David Swenson's deaf instrument, he shouted back into it, and he says, explain yourself, he says, don't be so obscure. And he said, I didn't think I was being obscure. He says, ask the man in the street. Find out what he complains about. That's what suffering is for him. He said, I can only say it's for me that all that I have received has been too good for me, a sinner. And the professor shouted back, you and your conviction of sin, that's pure egotism. Well, he said, that's good to hear. He says, it's always nice to be chastised. I'm sometimes in danger of being a little proud of it, he said. So, he said, maybe it's a little whimsical about it, but he said, I thought, well, he says, as for me, I am convinced of my own righteousness, you see. So it's his point. And I said, well, you think you're God, try acting like him. God is love, try loving and see how much love there's in you. And the professor of psychology looked at me and says, words of wisdom out of the mouth of babes, and the meeting broke up. But you could sense the demonic kind of hostility in there, that we should actually be challenged by actually performing that which we had just stated and professed. That we should be expected to love. Isn't it enough that we speak about it, talk about it, and be involved in our own way in it? Of course, like the prelate. We'll bring this up at the next philosophy club. But the professor of psychology, I don't know what was happening. He had enough in him to say, well, words of wisdom out of the mouth of babes, he threw at me. But where does it hit you? Where does it strike the ground? Isn't that it again? Where am I standing in the way of love? When I have more knowledge and I've read more books and I have more experience, then I will come into it.
There's one idea in there. God's solidity, and why are the people in heaven talking about the solid people, and what is it that, what effect is just the blades of grass, the waves, I think that's a beautiful thing, a rock, away the river, and the fellow realizes that the river, although it's moving, is hard.
Saves me from myself, because
instead of the whole world being something that I'm thinking up in my head, and there isn't really anybody else, and I'm really all alone, and that's really hell.
But it has a substance to it, and a kind of substance that I think is really evidenced in people who have been at the village. I can think of a number of people offhand who, you know, as they say, displace more when they go. You know, like the boat, it's further down in the water. It has more substance. I don't.
I always like to use that image from the healing of the blind man, where he first sees people like trees walking. You know, he's starting to see, and his mind hasn't reversed the images yet. One of those delightful things we get from a first century healing that we can see in terms of 20th century science. But he still hasn't, you know, when we still haven't grasped people and they're still shadowy, and then they come alive with reality. That those of you who are reading Kierkegaard's Works of Love will be really grasped by that as he discusses that through that old book. When people become real, it's Christ who brings that reality before us, their solidity, that destroys our solitariness, as Keith has said so well.
Yeah, and then the idea too in the book that, you know, it's you know, unless a seed fall into the ground and die. That's always the hard one. It's always been the hard one for me. But then the elements are held together in that fact. And I think that's something he makes really, really, really well pointed in the book, that Christ holds these parts together. You know, otherwise, there's jumble.
Maybe something I was saying about the power effect of Christ, also the difficulty of walking on the grass and everything. There's no comfort without the acceptance. There's no comfort. They have no comfort without the acceptance. Well, acceptance.
One of those people had the slightest bit of humor, you know, as that little spark there, the little sense of laughing at yourself. I'm in the midst of reading again the last book by the only book by John Berryman, the only novel called Recovery, where he's Berryman. Yeah. He's trying to recover out of his alcoholism. If he just had a sense of humor about himself, if he'd only been able to laugh at all his past and not. You know, this, the first time this book was brought real to me was some years ago when Tom said, well, I guess what it means is that when we die, we're going to have to look back and say we were wrong. We were completely wrong. I was a big joke. And to laugh at oneself, to have that little spark that McDonald talks about, if there's just that faint spark, just the faintest of sparks, the spirit will be able to carefully blow and make that spark into the solid, the real flame, going up like a, you know, like a burning forest fire, I guess is what they say.
Yeah, and just I like that idea of the spirit blowing, because otherwise, you know, we clutch not only everything that the spirit gives us, but all kinds of other trash, like hot pins, you know, in your fist. And so, you know, you get a gift from the Holy Spirit, okay, you know, and then that gift will eventually become a rotten apple, you know, that it becomes time too for that gift to be blown away, you know, say, okay, we give this up, you know, now what do I get, you know, what's next, you know, and the Holden Village prayer takes on a different meaning, but you're open to that kind of influence. I think in the preface to the Screwtape Letters, Lewis quotes Luther, mm-hmm. and says, I think that's where it is, but he says, the devil, you can always chase the devil away with music, and if that doesn't work, laughter is infallible medicine.
Yeah.
Something like that.
The devil can't stand to be mocked.
Right, the devil can't stand to be mocked. Laugh at it.
Your sense of humor in hell, that's
yeah.
Another thing about Berryman, the delusions, etc., he does have them.
Yeah.
He does have the humor in his last book, I guess. I haven't read it yet, but he all loses it together. Remember the last line of that Delusions book is all the dark, same my dance, my blue head all.
Yeah.
That is a response, one response of many that I think each person should have to this book. All the black same is that I'm all those folks.
Yeah.
I won't stay on. I'm going to dance my blue head off. And to get that humor and that celebration in the face of that the reality of the mundane depravity of most of our lives.
But part of that too, isn't part of that too laughing at ourselves, knowing that we're going to fall into those characters again, you know? That we're going to be, we're not always going to be able to sit back and laugh at ourselves, but we're going to be back in the muck and the mire.
But we will continually, but not consistently.
Right.
But that sin against the Holy Spirit, that there can't be any change. I'm all those guys that can't change.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do it again tomorrow, but not all of them.
Right. I'm going to be able to laugh again. What's funny, too, though, is that laughing at yourself is looking outside of yourself long enough to look back in again. I remember that scene where he sends in this herd of unicorns to try to at least scare the woman into seeing somebody besides herself. You know, just if she could just be frightened, just to see these unicorns, at least there was hope then.
That was a woman who was too ashamed to be, too ashamed to come in heaven.
She wasn't dressed right.
She wasn't dressed right. She wasn't the right kind of shade. She didn't know there'd be such reality around her that she'd have to look like this. One part of hope, one part of comfort, I guess, I got. Tom is the artist. He should read this part. Where it is. With the painter. Do you remember when he's talking to the painter? A couple of former famous painters. One of them is a spirit. The other one's a shade. And Tom, page 79. Could you just... I love Tom's voice.
Where's this at?
Well, you can just start reading and then people can go on this knowledge.
Now? No.
Yeah. But the thing is that this painter's, you know, what the spirit says to him in the end, it's in chapter...
Oh, the part where it says, go on.
Yeah. Chapter 9.
Yeah. Okay, I'll read that. You want to read that?
Yeah, I'll be the spirit.
God!
God what?
What do you mean, God what?
In our grammar, God is a noun.
Oh, I see. I only meant by God or something of the sort. I meant, well, all this. It's... I should like to paint this.
I shouldn't bother about that just at present if I were you.
Look here. Isn't one going to be allowed to go on painting?
Looking comes first.
But I've had my look. I've seen just what I want to do. God, I wish I'd thought of bringing my things with me.
That sort of thing's no good here.
What do you mean?
When you painted on earth, at least in your earlier days, it was because you caught glimpses of heaven in the earthly landscape. The success of your painting was that it enabled others to see the glimpses too. But here you are having the thing itself. It is from here that the messages come. There is no good telling us about this country, for we see it already. In fact, we see it better than you do.
Then there's never going to be any point in painting here?
I don't say that. When you've grown into a person, it's all right, we all have to do it. There will be some things which you'll see better than anyone else. One of the things you'll want to do is to tell us about them. But not yet. At present, your business is to see. Come and see. He is endless. Come and feed.
That will be delightful.
Come then.
How soon do you think I could begin painting?
Don't you see you'll never paint at all if that's what you're thinking about?
What do you mean?
Why, if you're interested in the country only for the sake of painting it, you'll never learn to see the country.
But that's just how a real artist is interested in the country.
No, you're forgetting. That was not how you began. Light itself was your first love. You loved to paint only as means of telling about life.
Oh, that was ages ago. One grows out of that. Of course, you haven't seen my later works. One becomes more and more interested in paint for its own sake.
One does indeed. I also have had to recover from that. It was all a snare. Ink and catgut and paint art were necessary down there, but they are also dangerous stimulants. Every poet and musician and artist, but for grace, is drawn away from love of the things he tells to love of the telling, till down in deep hell they cannot be interested in God at all, but only in what they say about him. For it doesn't stop at being interested in paint, you know. They sink lower, become interested in their own personalities, and then in nothing but their own reputations.
I don't think I'm much troubled in that way.
That's excellent. Not many of us had quite got over it when we first arrived. But if there is any of that inflammation left, it will be cured when you come to the fountain.
What fountain's that?
It's up there in the mountains, very cold and clear between two green hills. When you have drunk of it, you forget forever all proprietorship in your own works. You enjoy them just as if they were someone else's, without pride and without modesty.
That'll be grand.
Well, come. Do you want to keep reading? Well, come. Come.
Of course, they'll always be interesting people to me.
Everyone will be interesting.
Oh, yes, to be sure. I was thinking of people in our own line. Shall I meet Claude or Cézanne or...
Sooner or later, if they're here.
But don't you know?
Well, of course not. I've only been here a few years. All the chances are against my having run across them. There are a good many of us, you know.
But surely, in the case of distinguished people, you'd hear.
But there aren't any distinguished, no more than anyone else. Don't you understand? The glory flows into everyone and back from everyone like light in mirrors, but the light's the thing.
Do you mean there's no famous men?
They're all famous. They're all known, remembered, recognized by the only mind that can give a perfect judgment.
Of course, in that sense.
Don't stop.
One must be content with one's reputation among posterity, then.
My friend, don't you know?
Know what?
That you and I are already completely forgotten on Earth.
Huh? What's that? Do you mean those damned neo-regionalists have won after all?
Lord love you, yes. You couldn't get £5 for any picture of mine, or even of yours, in Europe or America today. We're dead out of fashion.
I must be off at once. Let me go, damn it all! One has one's duty to the future of art. I must be back to my friends. I must write an article. There must be a manifesto. We must start a periodical. We must have publicity. Let me go. This is beyond a joke.
But we're all solid when the light flows out. And the light flows into us and flows back. And I guess the comfort I get out of that, not from the ending. Oh, I'd like to sing his manifesto. I'd like to know who the neo-regionalists are, too. They seem to have won out. But I don't know. There's no place for enablers, but we are important. And I guess we come back to the psalmist, you know, that the Lord delights in us even though we're not especially delightful. And he delights in us, and therefore we can delight. I don't know. I guess there is comfort. But only, like Carol said, after the despair. Any questions? Does anyone have a part they'd like to read? That anybody been looking in the mirror and trying out the parts of the mother? There are some terrific characters that he builds up here. The woman who's talks about mother love, who's lost her son, a really painful situation. But the vain woman, the woman who's built her husband up into everything, who wants to take her husband back in tow. Give me back Robert. I'll take charge of him once again. all those, there are so many, and we didn't have any time to really go through these things in depth. But, you know, sit around and it's amazing how much laughter you can evoke, and at the same time, I guess, I don't know, what does Gilbert say, that you must always gild the philosophic pill? and that's what Lewis does, you know. While you're reading the book, that the book is reading you, I guess.
One thing that I would like to mention to everyone, and especially to the people in the lifestyle program, is when you have the opportunity, don't miss it to corner somebody or to let yourself be cornered and sit down with them and talk about the book. Because this morning I really had a good time. Went up to Carol and Mary's place and talked to Paul and Carol for an hour about the book. And it was really fun, and so much came out that I would never have picked up on my own, but only in things that they said brought out something in me. And there's a real kind of a real pleasure there in learning that takes place in that kind of framework. So don't wait for ivy colored walls and leaded windows at the college room to get in on the kind of fun that is.
I've always enjoyed the last chapter from one point of view. George Orwell, whom I dearly love for his great gifts, also changing his own mind, and that I grieve over because tuberculosis finished him off before his good friend Muggeridge got converted. And it might have happened for him too, despite that horrible adolescent experience with an evangelical, so-called evangelical school. It was sheer legalism and morality. But the way in which kind of the clay feet are allowed to show, George MacDonald's clay feet are showing, and I think C.S. Lewis allows his there too. There is a kind of pushiness in this kind of approach that he allows to be exposed at the very end again and to keep down. And don't make this all into another kind of an aestheticism. Realize that it is fantasy, and fantasy always has these aspects of ourselves put into them. And I know Orwell couldn't stand C.S. Lewis as far as his voice was concerned, and the way he'd come on over the BBC with a kind of rightness just to get him. And one can sense something of this even in the confession between George MacDonald and C.S. Lewis in the ending. For me, always rather revelatory there. So it's refreshing just the way it kind of comes out together. And you're not left being preached at.
There's one part here that struck me. I'll read it. It's in one of the conversations. Of, tell us the state of mind. Ye never said a truer word. In every state of mind left to itself, every shutting up of the creature within the dungeon of its own mind is, in the end, hell. But heaven is not a state of mind. Heaven is reality itself. All that is fully real is heavenly. For all that can be shaken will be shaken, and only the unshakable remains.
I think that's the nub of it. And it comes out in one of Paul Gerhardt's great hymns, in that final stanza again, in the same way he did. My merry heart is springing and knows not how to pine, is full of joy and singing and radiancy divine. The sun whose smiles so cheer me, a solid fact, is Jesus Christ alone. To have him always near me is heaven itself.
That reminds me of going back to the Chronicles of Narnia, those dwarfs at the end.
Mm-hmm.
What does George MacDonald say? What does Lewis F. George MacDonald say? There are two kinds of people.
Yeah. Those to whom.
Yeah.
Those. Let me see. How does that go?
Those who say to God.
Those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says, "Thy will be done."
Yes.